Accession number 29424, Reel 12.
Have people who are simply friends to each other and friends to the world. Jesus actually said, I call you my friends, to his disciples. I call you my friends. And so from that comes the society of friends, who worship without ordaining priests, without having bishops, and all this hierarchical stuff. They say, you know, we are all equal, men and women, gay and straight. Every human being is accepted within Quakerism, without any rules being imposed. So I think this has become a very important part of me. But it doesn't stop me remaining the Anglican priest that I was ordained. In other words, I think the traditional putting us in denominational boxes, and you close the door once you're in the box, to me is rather silly and not very intelligent. No one Christian organization, church, denomination, call it what you like, can encompass the whole truth. They all express truth in different ways. I love the Russian Orthodox Church because of all my Russian contacts. Its glorious music and its liturgy and its spirituality. I could find a home in many bits of Christianity, and often I find I have more in common, though, with some decent humanists who are not Christians at all. So, you know, boundaries, I think, are damaging. And we've got to break down all the boundaries between Christian denominations, between different religions, and between religion and the secular world. There's a place for all these things, and all of them express some aspect of truth. Some people find that very confusing. They want simple answers. They don't want to go through life with questions. They want to find somebody who can give them the answer. And, well, I don't mind if people need that, provided the answers they're given are answers that are compatible with tolerance, compatible with love. But when those answers open the door to hatred and exclusiveness, then I'd rather have no religion at all.
That's a lot to think about, yes. Going back to the sort of aftermath of 9/11 and these wars, the big wars that are still going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, really over a million British people demonstrated, didn't they, against, particularly against the war in Iraq. This would be in February 2003. It's incredible that the government didn't listen to such, you know, this populist opinion, which was expressed so forcibly. Do you have any views on that? And were you involved at that time with these anti-war demonstrations? I'm sure you spoke out against it, because I remember hearing something.
I was just one of the millions on the street.
Yes.
You know, I wasn't in any kind of leadership role in that demonstration. And of course, it was quite obvious where my heart was. And of course, there are many, many, many demonstrations going on all the time locally here and where I live in Brighton. We have had lots of, you know, demonstrations against the involvement of British troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I have to remind myself that once upon a time, long ago, I read politics at university. And the British Constitution was one of the things I had to learn about. And the British Constitution is a pretty dangerous thing because it's not written down. It relies entirely on tradition. And if the people are not democratically educated, if the people are not actually involved, it leads to democratic dictatorship is what I would call it. In other words, there is an elected body called Parliament, and there is a cabinet within Parliament, and there is a prime minister within the cabinet, a hierarchical structure, which means that in the end, election every 5 years and that's it. And there are no limits put on Parliament. And Parliament puts no serious limits on its cabinet and, above all, its prime minister. So that Britain, through the personality of Margaret Thatcher and the personality of Tony Blair, and they are extraordinarily similar personalities, who believe that they know the answers, almost that God has called them to be what they are, and the constitution enables them to do more or less what they like. It's a presidential system without the constraints on the president that the American constitution has. And that has led to the fact that public opinion counts for relatively little. Of course, in the long run it does. In the long run it does mean that governments lose power if they behave like the present one has done and like Margaret Thatcher did. But if certain things have already been done, they're fait accompli, they're done. They can't be undone. So I think at the moment, as a political scientist, I think we're in trouble in Britain. Our democracy doesn't work and people are disillusioned by it. Fewer and fewer actually go to vote because they see no point. Leading personalities do what they like. The paradox is that in a closed society, in a dictatorship, the opposition of even a small group causes ructions and causes extraordinary problems. But in our sort of system, a million people can go on the street and it makes no difference. If the equivalent of our million went on the street in China, as they tried to when Tiananmen Square came, either the government would fall, or they would have to bring out the tanks and shoot them down, which they did. But we have somehow so anesthetized the people that we say, well, yes, it's all right, you can go on the streets. And everything will go on as though you weren't there. And I don't know the answer to this. I don't know what the political answer is.
Yes, as you say, it's only once in 5 years, isn't it, that one has a chance.
One has a chance, but you can only change to another group of people, to another group of people operating the same system with more or less the same ideas. In other words, what actually separates the political parties is so small that you could say we live in a kind of three-party dictatorship where the parties have policies that are so similar that the only thing you change is the people running it and not the nature of the system. In other words, we have a given system which we can't change. All we can do is change the people who run the same system, which is different to what the Soviet Union had, in that you couldn't even change the people. You had the one system which declared itself to be perfect, so there was no need to have elections, real elections, so it couldn't change the people even. We can change the people.
Yes, it's interesting, this group which have formed themselves mainly related to troops who've been killed, parents of same, who are going to stand at the next election and run so many candidates. I suppose one could say that that is a glimmer of doing it through the democratic parliamentary
Yes,
electoral
I mean,
system.
we have still all sorts of ways of expressing protest, and the sort of thing that one person saying to the Foreign Secretary at a Labour Party conference, rubbish, he gets thrown out. But that is such a scandal. That he then gets elected to the executive committee of the party. In other words, there are still all sorts of hopeful signs built into our traditions. You know, if you get up at the right moment and shout rubbish, you are heard. If you've got the courage. So I'm not entirely pessimistic.
Right. Well, I wonder if we go on to our next topic, Paul, and if there's anything else you wish to say
I think
about
in
this.
that kind of area,
You've
we've
covered
covered
it
it
very
quite well.
well, yes. I was going to ask you about the if you're still prepared to go on for a
Oh,
bit,
sure.
but I must ask, are you comfortable
Very
still there?
comfortable. Yeah, absolutely fine.
I hadn't asked you an awful lot about the your ministry at Coventry. And obviously you were the director of the International Centre for Reconciliation, am
Right.
I right?
Yes.
That was your role there. And what this sort of meant to your life and ministry, really.
Well, 1955-56 were kind of keynote years in my life. In 1955, I sort of ended my period of working for church bureaucracy. I ended my period as International Secretary of the British Council of Churches, and I was looking for something new and creative to do. And this bombshell happened that a diocese in New Zealand elected me as its bishop, and my reputation was enough to get that vetoed. It was a very interesting, partly painful, partly affirmative, that a diocese in the country I was born in and its capital city should want me to be their bishop. And I didn't really want to be a bishop because I knew I was administratively not very clever, and I didn't want to particularly leave Britain and go to New Zealand, neither did my wife. But when the challenge came, we said, okay, we'll go. And then the whole thing went pear-shaped because I was considered to be too radical. My Quakerism was held against me. A great row began in New Zealand. And so the whole thing unraveled. What was I to do? Go back and just be vicar of a parish? I would have done it if that was the only choice I had. I certainly was the one moment in my life was actually looking for a job. Previously, you know, I'd always been sort of offered jobs and I knew what the next thing was, but I didn't know what the next thing would be. So it was rather remarkable that the Dean of Coventry Cathedral had got together enough money again, because cathedrals are always beggars. Or at least some cathedrals are always beggars, to revive the history of Coventry Cathedral, which was a history of international reconciliation. It had been destroyed in the Second World War. It had a dean, they used to be called provosts in those days. It had a provost who had a vision of reconciliation with Germany, and he declared this in the middle of the war and was hated for it, made himself very unpopular. But that was the tradition of Coventry. Its cathedral was destroyed by German bombs, and said, we will go out and make peace with Germany. We will make friends with Germany when this war is over. And they did very effectively. It was a very moving story. And of course, this international work of Coventry Cathedral, first of all, was headed up by its second provost, Bill Williams, who had great prophetic vision, and he really put Coventry on the map internationally. But money began to run out. When he retired, there wasn't enough money for another international director, and the new temporary dean was not particularly interested. So it looked as though this might all be written off as an interesting part of history. But when Colin Semper came from the BBC, where he was head of religious broadcasting, to be the dean for the next 5 years, he said, we've got to revive this and we've got to find the money. And this was at the very moment when I was looking for a job. And we'd once worked together at the BBC many years ago. And he rang me up and he said, look, I'm going to advertise the job of international director. You better apply. I immediately saw that this was like a job created for me. With, you know, I had all the credentials and all the background for this unique job, because no other cathedral in England has such a job, and sees its role as being international reconciliation and peacemaking. So in 1956, I became, in effect, the second international director, even though there were several years between my predecessor going and me coming, years when there wasn't enough money to pay him. But I knew my predecessor well, Kenyon Wright, who was a Scot who had gone out to work in India and came from India to Coventry. And we were friends, so I could tap his experience and knowledge. And 1956, and I, 1986. And I retired in 1997. So it was 11 years, my last paid job. And yes, what does it mean to me? It's one of the few things that I find it actually hard to put into words. Obviously, my many international contacts would continue, would enable me to go on traveling to Eastern Europe. This was still when the Cold War was very cold, and when the danger of hot war was real. So I was able to continue my many visits to East Germany, to Czechoslovakia, even once to Russia, though usually they wouldn't let me in, and building these links across the Iron Curtain, as it was called, was something that I had done throughout my work for the British Council of Churches, and Coventry enabled me to continue to do it. I was able to continue my work in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. In fact, I would think that in my Coventry time, my South Africa involvement remained the most important thing to me. But I was able, and that is something that now continues very successfully, to actually take this symbol of the cross of nails. The nails were the nails lying in the ruined cathedral that German bombs had destroyed, that a young priest, there were about 100, well, they think there were about 300 nails lying around that held the beams together, and these nails turned into crosses, old medieval nails, and these crosses were sent to many places in the world. I mean, the first one was to Stalingrad in Russia. So I was able to build on this tradition of what is now called the community of the cross of nails around the world, to take crosses of nails to places and to commit them to the work, to work for peace and reconciliation in their own way alongside Coventry. So creating new cross of nails centres, especially in Germany, Catholic ones, Protestant ones, and others that had no particular church connection, so that the work that the previous dean had done in the United States, where there was already a thriving Cross of Nails community, now was able to spread through Germany as well. so that the German community of the Cross of Nails, and I was kind of father of it, given my background, that was not too difficult, became a very important part of German church life today. And it's independent of Coventry now. It has its own life, it has its own constitution. So here are Christian centres in Germany working for reconciliation, in the Middle East working for reconciliation, in Eastern Europe healing old wounds in one way or another. So that's work, but a lot of the work you couldn't define in terms of doing, but much more in terms of being, of welcoming people to Coventry from around the world, of welcoming young people, sharing the story of reconciliation, using the ruins and the rebuilt new modern cathedral as symbols that express a great deal, taking people on a pilgrimage through all this, sharing the history and saying, now go and build your own place of peace where you are. I created, together with the dean who arrived after me, John Petty, together we forged links with Japan, which the cathedral hadn't done. We had the wonderful gift from a wonderful old woman of 90 of the peace statue, which she's a great sculptress. Dabas Gonçalves is her name, because she actually married a Brazilian, and so she has a Portuguese name, but she's very English, and she's a great sculptress, and she made actually for the School of Peace Studies at the University of Bradford a beautiful statue of symbolizing reconciliation. And Richard Branson actually paid for having casts of this made for important symbolic places. So there is now this beautiful statue in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral. We took another to the Peace Park in Hiroshima. There is another one at in Belfast, and perhaps the most symbolic one is the one that stands at the chapel where the communists blew up a church in order to build the Berlin Wall. Where the Berlin Wall went, there was a church that the communists dynamited in order so the wall could run at that point. Well, now there is a beautiful little chapel, and it's become a Cross of Nails chapel with this beautiful statue by this wonderful old woman who died a few months ago. These are a lot of symbolic acts. And as I say, my Coventry time, I suppose, is that my last job, it was a less activist sort of ministry. As I say, it was much more being than doing. I can't say we created anything new. We simply built on a wonderful tradition of peacemaking that I inherited at the cathedral, and there are probably no other places in Britain quite like it.
Yes. And in light of the earlier work that you did, it must have been marvellous to have had something with a reputation of Coventry with its reconciliation, which is what you're all about. Sort of behind you.
Well, exactly. It was handed to me on a plate in a way. I didn't have to create it. I just had to interpret it to the world.
I suppose you were part of it, weren't you? Really,
I was reminded, of course, the sub-dean, when I arrived, he said to me, "Don't you remember that I said to you many years ago that my dream was that you would come and work here?" And I said to him, "No, I don't remember, I'm afraid." I'd quite forgotten. And that indeed, there is a continuity in that in my first job, which was at the BBC, the BBC sent me to Coventry to put on the air, to broadcast the launching of the international ministry by Coventry Cathedral. So I was sitting in a BBC broadcasting van, broadcasting this great international service, when the Dean, Bill Williams, as it were, proclaimed to the world that this was going to be a centre of international reconciliation. And I was, the technician broadcasting this to the world. And of course, I didn't dream that one day I'd be working there.